Hi, welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. Well, for hour two of today's show, it's my great pleasure to welcome back to Truth News Radio Craig Isherwood from the Citizens Electoral Council. Of course, we had Eliza Barwick on a couple of weeks ago talking about some important global issues. Craig is coming on to continue to look into the questions about the protections for depositors and the need for a bail-in, the need to prevent a bail-in type scenario occurring in Australia. And I will now welcome Craig to the show. Craig, are you there?
Yes, thanks, Harold. Good to be back on again.
Indeed, thanks. Indeed. Now, Craig, we've discussed before the problems about banks and governments essentially using citizens, using the deposit funds of ordinary people to basically bail in the banks. It's obviously happened a couple of times. It's happened in Cyprus, and there are threats that it will happen again. Can you just run us through everything that you know and the measures you're trying to take to help prevent this occurring in Australia?
Okay, I can do that, Harold. For those new listeners that may not be familiar with this term, bail-in, it's effectively what took place in Cyprus last March when the Cyprus banks got into trouble. The way that they tried to solve that problem within the banking system is that they literally stole people's deposit. They actually forcibly converted their deposits into shares. Now, that's called bail-in. What the banks are now moving, as you said in your introduction, what the banks are now doing, Harold, is here in Australia, they're organising for the same sorts of bail-in laws via a financial systems inquiry run by David Murray. Now, this was something that Joe Hockey has had promised prior to the election. It now has released its interim report, where literally they're not taking this idea of bail-in off the table. Now, the financial systems inquiry asks a couple of really very important questions, which, if you know a lot about bail-in like we do, you already sort of know why they're asking these questions. But what it's asking is it possible to reduce the perceptions of an implicit guarantee for systemic financial institutions, that is, too big to fail banks, by imposing losses on particular classes of creditors during a crisis without causing greater systematic or systemic disruption? If so, what types of creditors are most likely to be able to bear losses? Now, what that question is asking, or actually implying, is that there is only one type of creditor that can wear the losses without actually affecting the entire financial system, and that is depositors, people who put their money into the banks, because they are creditors. Now, just last week, we have seen another bail-in slash sort of bail-out operation take place, and that's in this Portuguese bank called Banco Espírito Santo. It's just been bailed out by the taxpayers there, something in the vicinity of 4.9 billion euros. But also, this has been combined with the form of bail-in, because this bank has been very insolvent for a long time. And what they began to do is sell bonds to their depositors in order to transfer the liability from deposits into these basically worthless bonds. Now that the bank has gone belly up, the Portuguese government has done exactly what the Cyprus people have done, and that they've created a new bank called Novo Banco, and they've transferred all the good assets into that new bank, and they've left the shareholders and these bondholders that used to have a lot of money as deposits wear the losses. So it's sort of like an implicit backhanded bail-in operation. Now, what's really interesting also is that the Banco Espírito Santo would have liked to have been able to grab its hands on people's deposits. it's part of this bank has operated under EU capital rules and the bail-in regimes, and also ensured its authorities, or the authorities, that it was also ring-fenced, and I'll come to that later term in a minute, ring-fencing, which was supposed to stop this sort of problem from happening. However, even with all those sorts of implicit guarantees, it's still basically gone under, and people have lost a lot of money. This is in a country like Portugal where their debt, their private and public debt, is something like 360% of their GDP. So they're an absolute basket case financially. So what's happened, that this idea of bail-in is being proposed implicitly and somewhat directly by the Murray Financial Systems Inquiry in this country. And no one else has been campaigning against this except the Citizens Electoral Council. And we've been now on this for over 12 months because we first discovered that back in April of last year, the Financial Stability Board, which is something that Kevin Rudd enthusiastically got Australia involved with, had put together a series of what's called a toolkit for the resolution of financially distressed banks. And one of those toolkit policies was, in fact, this idea of bail-in. So when you look at where we're heading currently, this is the intention that by the G20 meeting in November, where Australia is hosting the G20, they intend to try and announce some form of regulation or movement towards adopting these international Financial Stability Board standards here in Australia. Mark Carney, the head of the Financial Stability Board and also former head of the Bank of England, he has come out saying that the Brisbane meeting is going to be a very, very important meeting. Now, in the context of us shining a very strong light on this issue of bail-in, we've had a rather startling development in the last week, which may sound like some sort of a victory or partial victory to some people who have followed this subject matter for a little while, and that is that the head of the commission, David Murray, himself came out and said that we should be looking at some form of ring fencing, not what we call Glass-Steagall. And then straight away, the former visiting Bank of England Governor, Mervyn King, said that we need ring fencing as well. Now, what ring fencing is, it's a debate that's been really taking a lot of interest in the United Kingdom, in where the Bank of England is based, because a number of the leading figures in the House of Lords over there, their upper house, I suppose you'd call it, have come out and said that this ring fencing just will not work. Now, what ring fencing let me start by saying what we are proposing for the country, which is Glass-Steagall. We have a international banking system of which Australia is implicitly in tied up with. We have a huge amount of overseas loans and so forth tied up with the overseas banking system. But one of the biggest dangers that we see in our country is that we have something over $23 trillion worth of these things called derivatives, which are simply side bets on underlying financial instruments and so forth. Now, that 20 years ago, these things didn't exist.
Yeah.
But because they were illegal. And that's because we had a very, internationally, there was a very high degree of regulation. That came out of what was called the Glass-Steagall laws of 1933, where back then you had these huge banks that were using depositors' funds to gamble with in stock markets and all sorts of things like that. Now, this is one of the things that caused the collapse of the banking system in the 1929-30-31 period. And Franklin Roosevelt came in and said, well, to have an economy, you can't have a normal banking system, your normal commercial banking system, involved in this sort of activity. So we have to have a a new standard, and he brought in these laws called Glass-Steagall that stripped, that made it illegal for a commercial banking system, a commercial banking license, to be granted to an institution that had any merchant banking, investment banking, insurance companies, stock broking elements in it whatsoever. And he forced them, after a year, when this legislation came in, to break themselves up. So you simply had a bank that was a bank. It had its own board members. The bank board members were responsible for running that commercial banking operation. And then you had the merchant banking operation and the investment banking operations. They were separate, but they had no claims on the depositors' funds in the commercial banks. So they had their own board of directors. They ran their own show. And that was made law. And from 1933 right up until actually the 1980s, when they started to dismantle the Glass-Steagall legislation, you had no bank failures. You had no problems with the banking system globally because of that sort of regulation.
Can I just ask a quick question, Craig? Under that regime, what does a bank then do to raise funds or to do business? Because banks use depositors' funds, as I understand it, to do business. But if you're saying that under this regime they weren't allowed to do that, does that mean the money's just sitting in the bank and the bank couldn't do anything with it? Or what's the deal there?
Okay, well, when we're talking about commercial banking, Harold, we're talking about the normal bank's business, which is that they would raise funds from their shareholders. Those funds as capital would then be lent out and loaned.
Yeah.
As loans, mortgages, business loans, and that sort of thing. So you had the interest rates that would be made on the housing loans, and business loans would then make an income stream for the people who put their money into the banks, put their money in deposits.
Yeah.
But also the banks would get the interest from those loans to make itself profitable. But it was very narrowly defined. You could only lend into these areas. Whereas with merchant banks and investment banks, they could invest in much more speculative type activities. Put their money in the stock market or something like that, or buy into property development trusts and those sorts of things, right? Where the commercial banking system is very, very, very conservative, whereas the risk and the merchant banking, investment banking side of thing is much more risk orientated. So that's what happened for many, many years up until the early 1980s, when you started to see a lot more deregulation of Glass-Steagall, of the banking system, through the takedown of Glass-Steagall up until 1999, when unfortunately Bill Clinton got rid of Glass-Steagall altogether, and you saw a real takeoff in things like derivatives and these speculative instruments like derivatives that have caused a problem. So what ring fencing is, however, it's not Glass-Steagall. It's not the complete separation of these elements of the banks. It's effectively having the same board.
Craig, we're just going to break. Sorry to interrupt. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. I'm talking to Craig Isherwood. We will be right back after this very short break. Don't go away. You're listening to Truth News Radio Australia, going beyond the spin, deception and propaganda of mainstream news. Visit truthnews.com.au and subscribe now. Truth News Radio Australia. My guest today is Craig Isherwood from the Citizens Electoral Council, and we're talking about protecting Australia from catastrophic financial collapse and the bail-in, the haircut given to depositors rather than to banks, the threat being that we will all have our funds slashed if some catastrophic failure occurs, and there are various backroom discussions going on at the moment where they're trying to establish how they might do that, and there are precedents as well that have been set for this actually occurring. Craig, I wonder if we might just take a breather for a second, because you're talking about some really important issues. Can you just give us a quick primer on what derivative trading is? Because I just think it's a very important point. Can you just give an idiot's guide to what is derivative trading?
Well, they're basically classed as a form of insurance in a deregulated system. Like if you've got interest rates and you're trying to trade money overseas, for example, you would take out a derivative, an interest rate swap or something like that, where you would try and insure against the interest rates going up too high or down too low. But basically, they're an insurance policy that has taken out to prevent so-called losses. And you've got parties and counterparties to these deals. You've got the person who, you know, takes the bet and the person who puts the bet on. Now, there's a great vast majority of these things, $23 trillion dollars worth of the notional principal value of these things, and these things form a huge washing machine effect of the turnover in the financial monetary system today, even pretty much with inside Australia. And what happens is when someone loses their bet or there's some exposure to a loss, then that loss gets multiplied throughout the entire process whereby these derivatives through the entire system. Now, they're so irrational, Harold. It's somewhat hard to explain how they actually work. In fact, many people don't know how they work. They're sold by banks as effectively like insurance policies, whether they've been one of the main ones that's causing a lot of problems are these credit default swaps, where you know you have people that are buying bonds from governments. And the bonds fall in value or something, and then they say, well, we took out an insurance policy on that pay up, you know, because these bonds have fallen away, and then you find that the people who given any sold those bonds in the first place can't pay up, but they've also unsold those bonds to someone, or the credit default swaps to someone else. And the biggest problem with these things is that no one knows where the liabilities will fall, so it has a chain reaction effect across the entire system.
Yeah.
So that's effectively the nature of derivatives. To get into too much difficult, I think, will even confuse people more about these things. But you can get a sense from what I said. It's already confusing.
It's not easy. Yeah.
No, it's not easy at all.
I'm marginally.
Continue. And The problem we have is that our financial system is so full of these things, these confusing counterparty party arrangements, which are basically side bets and gambling bets. That's all they are. That's best characteristic for them. That unless you have a Glass-Steagall separation where you have a legitimate banking system and you write off these other derivatives, and there's something like $1.4 quadrillion of these things in the financial system globally today, of which I said before, $23 trillion in Australia. But what's coming through now with the established financial services inquiry is that David Murray's just come out calling for what's called ring fencing, which you've found in the United Kingdom under what's called the Vickers Inquiry over there. Now, ring fencing is not Glass-Steagall. Ring fencing is saying we promise, in effect, to keep our commercial banking operations separated from our merchant and investment banking speculative side of our operation, and we promise to do that. However, the reality is it's still one entity that governs both those two sides of the financial activity. And consequently, you know, people like Douglas Flint, the chairman of HSBC, Britain's largest bank and, of course, one of the world's largest bank, is asking the UK government not to force banks to comply with the new rules requiring them to ring-fence their commercial business from their basically more speculative casino type banking arms, because they know, basically, they have no intention of doing it in the first place. There was a tremendous discussion take place last, was it the end of last year, the 27th, the 26th, 27th of November, where the House of Lords vigorously debated this whole idea of ring fencing. And one of the Lords, Lord Forsyth of Drumline, who himself had spent 7 or 9 years as an investment banker, told the House of Lords that, quote, bankers are extremely adept at getting between the wallpaper and the wall. If they can find a way to get around something, they will. Right, and we know that. If you just think about the discussions that have been had in public about the Commonwealth Bank and the financial rip-offs that have gone through for our own Commonwealth Bank, you know, people have been lied to and so forth. You know, this is the nature of bankers.
Yeah.
Now, Lord Lawson, now that just happens to be Nigella Lawson's father, you know, the chef person, but his claim to fame is not that it's his father, but the fact that he used to be the former Chancellor of the Exchequer from 1983 to 1989. So he knows about banking. He knows about these sorts of issues. And what he said is very, very – he doesn't support this idea of the the Vickers Commission or the ring fencing either. Because he said in one point, the culture of retail banking and the culture of investment banking are two quite separate things.
Mm.
One is, or should be, a culture of caution and prudence. That is for the commercial banking side of things. The other is a culture of risk taking and a totally different order. This is the other thing that the Vickers Commission did not look at, he said. And what he said was, it's a very curious idea, this ring fence. It's never worked before. This idea of having one entity, but so-called splitting the commercial, so-called cautious and prudent side of the banking system off from the high risk side of things. It's never been done before. It's just a proposal being put up to placate the people in order so that these policies like bail-in would be able to come in. And the only policy that has worked, Herewood, is Glass-Steagall. It's the only policy that has, from 1933 right the way through until the 1990s, in effect, have seen that no banking system collapse anywhere around the world of any significance whatsoever.
Now, you said before that it's very confusing in trying to understand the way these derivative trades are done, which makes it hard to understand why it is that we face such a risk when your depositors' funds may be involved in those shady transactions. But one thing that's very clear and not complex at all to understand is when you go to the ATM and try to withdraw your money, if your balance has been reduced, that's very simple, isn't it?
Very simple. I mean, and these sorts of assurances given by the likes of Joe. I mean, we've had numerous times where Joe Hockey says, "Oh, we're not considering bail-in. We're not considering, you know, this concept of bail-in," but his own commission is coming out and literally implicitly talking about the fact that, or ask the question, what types of creditors are most likely to be able to bear losses? Well,
yeah.
Because you have all these counterparty and party arrangements inside the banks themselves, and a lot of the loans and the bonds and so forth are sold between the banks, you can't actually touch that without creating what's called a contagion between the banks.
Yeah.
You don't know where these things are going to blow up on you.
We're just going to break. You're with Truth News Radio Australia, talking to my guest Craig Isherwood from the Citizens Electoral Council. We'll be right back. Really interesting discussion. Hi, welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. And I'm talking to Craig Isherwood from the Citizens Electoral Council. We're talking about the financial situation with depositors' funds potentially being subject to acquisition for to rescue banks if banks start to fail. And, you know, I'd like to really get it back down to the very basic grassroots things that we can all understand, because we get into very highfalutin talk when we start talking about financial matters, and we forget that what it can come down to is, you know, you won't be able to pay your rent because your money won't be in your bank account. And as crude as that is actually what happens. And then you end up with a collapse in society. Then you end up with people on the street, hungry, angry, you know, and anger becomes a big problem because, you know, as Gerald Celente says, when people have nothing left to lose, they lose it. You know, that creates unrest, and that is met with police, and that is the outcome. Outside of all this highfalutin talk about complex financial issues, we're going to see tear gas and rubber bullets and maybe real live bullets, because this is what happens when people lose everything and they've got nothing left to do other than riot. I mean, can we – I don't want to break your flow, Craig, but I just want to really emphasize the dark side of what is impending here.
Well, I think bring it back to the property bubble in this country. Talk about the high rates of property values and so forth. This bubble was created in order to prop up the banks, particularly in the post-GFC period, right? Yeah. Because our banks were bankrupt. We know that Macquarie Bank rang up Kevin Rudd, this treasurer, what's his name? Temporary blockout. And he demanded that the government step in and give a guarantee.
Okay.
Right? And that was to prop up, to because Australia is so exposed to the overseas lending.
Yes.
It has to borrow a lot of money overseas all the time. Now, what is the Australian banks going to do if there is a marked downturn in the property market, something like a correction of 10 or 15%, which would wipe out the actual assets of the banks in terms of loan values to the real estate market, when they're already just a 4% downturn would cause them to be, you know, more visibly insolvent. Now, how are they going to make themselves solvent? Well, the only other way of doing that is either through a bailout, where the government puts taxpayers' money in, or you get rid of liabilities, so that your assets are bigger than your liabilities. When a bank is insolvent, it means that their assets don't measure up to their liabilities. They're less than their liabilities. That makes for an insolvent bank.
Sure.
And what you do, what you have to do is reduce your liabilities. So there's plenty of models around where literally those liabilities or depositors' funds, I said, okay, well, we can't afford to be bankrupt. We aren't going to be bailed out by the government. Therefore, we are going to take depositors' funds and we are going to forcibly convert those to shares. This is what happened in Cyprus.
Mm.
And they took the depositors' funds and they forcibly converted them to shares. What did they do? They took those shares at the value, at the initial value, at the frozen value amount, and then they floated the value of those shares afterwards, where they fell from, you know, 90 cents in the dollar to 3 cents in the dollar. So they got wiped out that way.
That's a nice sleight of hand, isn't it? So involuntary conversion of your funds to shares. And in the case of the Cyprus investors then, did their shares ever recover? I mean, it's been a few years now. What happened in the end?
No,
I mean, never recovered.
No, it's still locked down. I mean, They created a good bank and a bad bank.
Yeah, right.
In that case, there was a real freak out that took place when that was taking place, because the intention was to take a proportion of everybody's deposits. Now, Angela Merkel in Germany screamed, no, you can't do that, because 100,000 euros of everyone's deposits are protected.
Okay.
Now, they say that 250,000 of people's deposits here are protected. And I'll come back to that in a minute. But so what they did do is that, yeah, okay, the guaranteed deposits of people up to $100,000 were protected. But if you had a business, right, with money in that in those deposits above 100,000 euro, and you lost that money. That money was forcibly locked down and then converted into shares. And you lost – basically, you know, you've lost it. It's gone. You can't, you don't have access to it. They shut down Visa and MasterCard. They shut down the check transfer system. There was only allowed to take 400 euros out per day. You couldn't run a business. You couldn't run – no business could operate commerce. So what you were talking about before, about this idea of a run on the banks or going to the ATM and finding you don't have any money – that isn't so far-fetched when you're talking about the collapse of a major Australian bank. Now, do the authorities say that it's, can that happen? And they say, oh, no, it's not possible. The Australian banks are much stronger and so on and so forth. But come back to what I was talking about with the property market, and that's just the property market being so highly overvalued. If there were a correction because there was a war breakout against China, we lost a lot of our trade. People were laid off, couldn't get paid, couldn't pay their mortgages, and the property values collapsed through the floor. Then what's going to happen to the banks? The banks will be insolvent, and then there'll be laws. And I could see this bail-in laws being brought in under some sort of crisis conditions in order to save the banking system. This is how it's always done, because the people get very, 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 very frightened, and they'll say, well, let's fix this problem, let's fix this problem. And you know, we end up with...
And, of course, there's always talk about sacrifice, and a lot of people will go along with it because they think, yes, well, it's a, you know, a time of war or a time of crisis. We've all got to sacrifice a little, and it'll be justified in all kinds of ways like that, won't it?
Yeah, well, that's what we've talked about, and that's without any... crash in the international derivatives market with this, you know, these derivatives aren't just localized into Australia. They've got tentacles all over the world. I mean, that's one of the things that brought down Lehman Brothers, for example, in the United States. What you had there were these collateralized debt obligations, which were bundled up financial instruments, sold. These were mortgages, in effect, at the bottom end, sold to people who couldn't afford to pay them mortgage repayments, but they were given a grace period of a couple of years, right? And when the grace period was over the large numbers of people started defaulting on their mortgages, the cash flow that was supposed to have been coming from these mortgages dried up.
And then the value of those bonds, the derivative that were being traded, the contracts were traded as a commodity, the value of those then plummets too, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, these collateralized debt obligations were sold to hospital charities here, they were sold to councils, and they were sold at a certain face value based upon the return that the councils or these charities were able to get. And this was in turn there was a reset process in these mortgages that were at the basis of these collateralized debt obligations. Like, people would only have to pay a small amount of interest for the first several years, and then there'll be a reset, you know, a hideous reset of, you know, maybe initially 2% interest and then reset at 7 or 8%. So poor people may have managed for 2 or 3 years, and then all of a sudden they get hit with this reset interest rate. They had to default on their mortgages. So the mortgage repayments that were coming all dried up. So the value of these underlying mortgages dropped, the cash flow dropped out, and the collateralized debt obligations that were bundled up with these things, which were basically – and as you see, they're quite a bit removed from having a mortgage. They're just – you're basically monetizing a cash flow and selling that monetized cash flow for a fixed value, and you're giving it a title, you might say, and then the credit rating agencies like Moody's and so forth give it a AAA credit rating in order to be able to flog it off to institutions like councils that might have a bit of spare cash, which they should never be investing in these things in the first place.
Ludicrous.
But this is what's actually taking place in Australia today. Now, this is the nature of the financial system. There's actually a book by a former Morgan Stanley derivatives trader, Frank Partnoy. It's called Fiasco, Blood in the Water and Wall Street.
We'll talk about that when we come back. We're just going to break. We're with Truth News Radio Australia, back for one more segment with Craig Isherwood. Don't go away. Craig Isherwood from the Citizens Electoral Council. Craig, you were just mentioning a book there. Perhaps you'd like to continue where you left off.
Yeah, this is a book that we've all read in the office here. It's by former Morgan Stanley derivatives trader Frank Partnoy. And in this expose of these things called derivatives, if people really want to know what they're like, the book's called Fiasco, Blood in the Water on Wall Street. And in that book, he insisted the derivatives are basically sold to cover up losses and to make losses appear to be gains for short periods of time.
Wow.
Partnoy's admission has been, has obviously been proved from a number of cases, including the 1995 collapse of Barings Bank in 2001 bankruptcy of the U.S. energy giant Enron after years of using derivatives to cover their losses.
Mm.
And then, of course, as I mentioned before, the Lehman Brothers triggered meltdown. So that is pretty much the nature of what we're dealing with here. And this is the gambling side of the financial system, which is why we are saying you can't have an economy, you cannot have a country even, or the security of being able to develop a country, unless you have laws that protect the commercial side of your banking system, where they can't get involved in these financial gambling systems.
One of the problems, though, Craig, is that it would seem that the people who are in this business, who are engaging in these trades, must have some kind of severe psychological disorder. Because, I mean, the way you're describing it, it really looks to me like, you know, the only sort of person who would engage in this type of activity is someone with like a serious personality disorder who you know, is basically just playing the game of short-term gain for, you know, knowing that in the long term that there's going to be a disaster. It's a disordered state of mind to think that you can actually continue this way. And so it appears that we've got an industry, a community of people who are mentally unbalanced.
Have you seen that movie called The Wolf of Wall Street?
I have, and I was just thinking about that as I was talking about that. Yeah, and that film.
Now, I can't remember his name. Do you think that he represents a terribly stable personality type? You know, pornography, gambling, drinking, drugs, you know, that sort of outlook.
Yeah, and I think that film was actually a little bit sanitized. I got a feeling from that film that it wasn't totally genuine either, but it certainly did give you a taste of what these people are on about.
I agree with you. It is understated. That film was understated. It's Hollywood. It was Hollywood to sell and sanitized.
Yeah, it was romanticized a little, you know. And I think, right.
And I think the personality types that are involved in this, you know, this is why you've got to have regulation within a system in order to protect not to say that. Yeah, look, if people want to get involved in that sort of activity, fine.
Yeah.
That's fine.
If you want to gamble, if you want to go to the casino, it's your choice. But you have to be able to make that choice, not have it made for you. And, of course, when it comes to super funds, I mean, what's the deal there, Craig? I mean, what control does the average worker who entrusts their super funds to their provider have over this behavior?
As we've said in our organisation, the super guarantee going back to 1994 by Keating was designed again to prop up the banking system. Okay. You have an enormous amount of cash now put into the banking system. Yeah. And most people have no idea where their super is being placed. It's actually quite a complex process to go through and figure it out. Yeah. I mean, if you just only have to look at your own super for those who've got it and ask questions, and you begin very quickly to realize it's not that simple to find out, well, you know, where is my money actually being put? I mean, we were just having a discussion this morning. Once upon a time, like about up until about the end of last year, you could go to the Reserve Bank and buy a treasury bond, which meant you could go and buy something that gave you title to a debt issued by the government, a bond, which you could have title to, and you could use that title to, you know, put in the bank and even get personal loans against it or whatever.
So are you saying we can't do that anymore? Is that
that's been, what's happened now is that the big financial institutions can do that, but they sell units of those bonds now on the stock market. So you can go onto the ASX, the Australian stock market, and buy government securities, Australian Treasury bonds, in units of $100.
Yeah.
And you can actually – you're buying, in effect, a share in a Treasury bond. You're not owning the title to the Treasury bond.
How ludicrous is that?
So if you wanted the security of the title of a Treasury bond,
yeah,
you can't get it.
Yeah.
Unless you're a registered financial institution that is allowed to buy these things.
Yeah.
Now, there's an example of a derivatized product when you could once upon a time go to the Reserve Bank as Joe Blow, walk in there, pay over $100,000, $50,000, get a government bond.
Yeah.
Your name would be attached to the title of that bond that you owe, that, you know, that that's your bond that you're trading, whereas now you've basically got a share. And, of course, a share in anything is only is like a nominal value to the underlying asset. You don't have a share. You have a share in an underlying asset, which is where derivatives come in.
Wow.
Derivative is just a pledge to pay from a cash flow that comes from an underlying asset of some form. And the collateralized debt obligations was the pledge to pay from the cash flow that came from bundled mortgages. You've got other forms of derivatives. You can derivatize everything, anything. Anything you like.
Just a couple of really quick questions. We are at the end of the hour. Firstly, Craig, we've talked about bail-in, but what we've seen in Europe, and we've seen the drastic consequences of that, is the bailouts and the austerity measures, which are very severe in their own right. When taxes are raised and when the government slashes funding to all kinds of government-funded jobs, in a way, is the bailout and the bail-in just different ways of ripping people off, just different ways of getting money off people?
Yeah, the entire problem has been a takedown of the regulated Glass-Steagall system, where if people wanted to bet and gamble, they could, but they did it with their own money. What you've seen in the last 20, 25 years is the fact that the banks themselves are bankrupt. They're because the global financial physical economy, the investment into real infrastructure and development, has been nowhere near what it needed to be in order to maintain the sorts of standard of livings that we had in the 70s and the 80s. Now, that's a whole different discussion we can get into sometime in the future, maybe. But the point is that they've had to loot the physical economy by, for example, charging for things that once upon a time used to be considered just what governments did. For example, provide roads, provide water, provide, you know, cheap electricity.
Yeah.
Now, because the system is so broken down, that the physical economy, that which we produce from that infrastructure, is so broken down, the banks are saying, well, we now have to get our cash from somewhere else. So they're literally starting to loot the population itself by deregulation of the electricity system, by allowing these high fees and so forth to have to be paid by people using electricity, and then they argue the fact that government utilities and so forth are not efficient, and you know they try and destroy any idea of the fact that you can have a government that's responsible to provide infrastructure that is done on a cheap basis. And this is the fundamental issue for any economy. Actually, infrastructure should be up to 50% of an economy, right, where you actually the government is funding infrastructure to, in order to stimulate the ability for those the people with inside an economy, inside a country, to use that infrastructure to do other things, to creative things, to manufactures and so forth. So we don't have level playing fields in this country at all, even though that's what they talk about trying to create all the time. We are in this country pitted with cheap labour from other countries, and consequently that is what's seeing the current unemployment rates starting to increase around our country, because we're losing one industry after another. And this is all based upon the need for banks in particular to make these huge profits. This is the nature of the system and the specifics.
And of course, one last point I just want to get in about real estate, because a lot of this hinges on real estate, as you've indicated. There has been a real loss of living income for people because of the skyrocketing price of real estate, to the extent that people are paying up to 50% of their income simply on repaying a mortgage or paying the rent. And again, this is stripping money away from people. It's just another way of stripping money off people, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. That's the entire property bubble. It makes it impossible for people to get into cheap housing.
You can't get ahead in your life. You can't progress in your life. You're just treading water trying to pay for the roof over your head.
Well, see, in the past generation, my father's generation was able to save and create some degree of wealth.
Yeah.
When they bought a house, they got a 5,000 or 5,000 pound loan. It was fixed at a fixed interest rate for 25 years.
Yeah.
So consequently, there was no, they had to have a certain amount of deposit in order to get that loan in order to build the house. Therefore, the house that they built was a very basic house. And as they lived in that house over the last 50 years, they slowly had made additions to it as the extra income would allow for that. That they were able to amass, aside from the house, other incomes.
Craig, we're at the end of the hour. Sorry, mate, to interrupt.
That's all right.
It's been great talking to you today, and I do hope to get you on again. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, Harold.
That's Truth News Radio Australia for another week. We'll be back next week. See you then, folks.